This episode of the Balanced Brain podcast contains themes of suicide, child abuse, and sexual violence. It may not be suitable for all listeners.
This is a Balanced Brain podcast with your hosts, Melanie Nicholson and Sean Clift.
Welcome back to the Balanced Brain podcast. My name's Sean Clift, and I'm joined again by my good friend and co-host, Melanie Nicholson. Melanie, how are you? Welcome back. Another year.
Yes, and our first episode of 2023.
Yeah, it's been great to have a little bit of a break, but we're back into it now, and we've got some really exciting things planned for the year, and a couple of really great guests. We've got a really great guest for our first episode. We're joined today by Anna Birch, who's a friend of yours, Melanie, yes, and has got a book out called Blossom in the Dust. So I'll throw it to you, Mel. Let's welcome Anna to the show.
Hi, Anna.
Hi, Melanie. Hi, Sean.
Hello.
You know, we have been writing together for quite a few years, but and I just want to hit the listeners with the tagline of the book, which I think is the theme of everything. I vowed then that I would never let the bastards win, and I didn't. So tell us about the book. Tell us what the story is.
Oh, all right, Melanie. I suppose when I was a teenager, I wanted to write a book, but I never really thought much about actually doing it. It was just sort of something I had in the back of my mind. And then as I've, you know, become an adult and gotten my act together, I was thinking about writing a book, and as life happens, I was sitting on the computer and across Facebook, an ad came for a writing class in Newcastle. So I thought, oh, that's fortuitous. So I thought I'll go and do that. And it was really the impetus for me to write the book. I can't thank the course enough for giving me the confidence to write. David, who was the teacher, he gave me permission to be, what's the word? He gave me permission to speak my truth, I suppose, because I'm very much, you know, just tell me the facts, whereas he showed me how to describe a setting and to the point where with the book, if you read the book, then you're there with me because of the way it's written, because that's the way I wanted to write it. I wanted to write a book that the reader could imagine themselves in the situations that I was in, rather than being removed from the situation and being an observer, because I wanted my book to have power in it and to hopefully give power to others who have been through the same or similar circumstances that I have. And just to give you a bit of information about my life, my uncle sexually abused me from when I was 2 till I was 15, and on a regular basis, sometimes 2 or 3 times a week. And my mother was an abusive alcoholic, and it was just atrocious. When I was 9, she stabbed her boyfriend in front of my brother and I, and then proceeded to kick him for bleeding on the carpet. So that just gives you a bit of an idea about what my childhood was like. And, you know, from week to week I was covered in bruises, but only on my body and my upper arms or upper legs where no one could see them, because, you know, I didn't realise until I was sitting in a lecture one day, and the lecturer was talking about child abuse and actually said that exact thing, that when kids are abused, they're often hit in areas where they can't, where the bruises and things can't be seen. And it just hit me like a bolt of lightning that I didn't realise that mum controlled that side of her abuse so well, rather than it just being flagrant abuse, if that makes sense.
But, and it was also during, you know, the 60s and 70s where a lot of that was actually even hidden in the community. So people turned a blind eye, and that is, you know, in the book there may have been witnesses, there probably were witnesses, but they closed the door behind them so they didn't hear anything. And and I think that was really, and it's still not really out in the open, but it's a much more, but back then there was kind of this veneer of this idyllic life in the 60s and 70s, but behind closed doors, I think that's what struck out to me the most, and that is, you know, what was going on.
Yeah, people ignored it. I think the mantra of families and communities was what happens behind closed doors stayed behind closed door, and it was nobody else's
business. No one else's business.
That's right. And, like, we lived in... So I'll give you a bit of background. I was born out of wedlock. My mother and my biological father and my brother lived in Broken Hill. And then when my mother found out she was pregnant, she moved back to Maitland to stay with her sister until I was born. And then she was going to give me up for adoption. But my auntie stopped her from doing that because she didn't want to lose me from the family. And so I lived with my aunt for about the first 3 years of my life, and that's obviously when the abuse started with my uncle. And then when I was about 3 and a half or so, my mother came and got me and took me to Broken Hill. We were there for a year or two, and then we moved back to Maitland. And when we moved back to Maitland, we moved back with my aunt, but we ended up moving into a flat and then a semi-detached house. So in both of those places, we had neighbours that were next to the other side of our walls, and no one ever did anything. Like, I could hear them talking, and they could obviously hear me and my brother screaming, but they didn't bat an eyelid, and they didn't do anything to help. And one night I'd left it. Mum was at the hotel, which she spent most of her evenings. And when I was about 7 or something, we had neighbours who had a daughter the same age as me, and we were quite good friends. And I asked her mum if I could stay the night, or her daughter asked her mum if I could stay the night. And her mum said, oh, I'll make sure that you leave a note for my mother. So her name was Debbie, and which I did. And then mum came home, you know, like 10:30, 11 o'clock or something at night, and we were all in bed, and she bashed on the door, and Debbie's mother opened the door, and mum just stormed through the house trying to find me, like waking up everybody, turning on the lights in all the bedrooms, screaming, where was I? And eventually found me, and then grabbed me by the hair and dragged me back home and belted the daylights out of me. But I could see the neighbours, you know, peering through the creases of their curtains and all of that sort of stuff. But nobody ever said a thing. Nobody ever did anything. Even when mum stabbed her boyfriend, my brother ran up to the ambulance station, which was probably about a kilometre from our place, and the ambulance came down and he was taken to hospital. As mum, my brother and I were also taken to hospital, not that we were injured or anything, but just because mum couldn't leave us by ourselves and whatever, or seemingly couldn't leave us by ourselves. And he ended up coming back to live with us after he was fixed up. But not even the police were called, because he made up a story that he'd tripped on was carrying a breadboard and a knife and tripped and stabbed himself. Whereas obviously that wasn't what happened. And just
why do you think he did that?
Well, if mum went to jail, then what was going to happen to me and my brother?
Okay, so he was looking out for you.
Well, I can only assume that. I don't know. I have no idea. I can only assume that. And in my mind, that makes the most sense.
Right.
And I did, you know, I got a sense in the book that you did have these, you know, I guess helpers or guardian angels, but it was never in a direct way that would actually help you, but it was always in these roundabout ways that you had support there. But it just always seemed to be that no one ever actually, you know, called the police or called child services. But you did have some moments throughout your childhood where there were people assisting you, and as I said, even your mother's partners. And can you tell us with, you know, how that, I guess, helped to give you where it was possible to have a safe space or to have even build trust with adults when you're a kid?
Mm. I don't know that I ever felt that I have had a safe space apart from probably my dad's place, which is my brother's father, not my biological father, because he still lived in Broken Hill. But I was actually brought up thinking that my brother's father was my father until I was 16, I think. And he was just such a beautiful man, but he was very quiet and unassuming and basically the exact opposite to what Mum was. And I suppose that just gave me a space to breathe. And I actually ran away to his place when I was about 12 or something. And after about 3 days or 4 days or something, Mum sent a taxi to come and pick me up. But I was just heartbroken that I had to go home because it was just so horrible. I can't, you know, I say it's horrible, but I cannot begin to really express how hard it was. It was just terrible.
What's quite amazing to me, Anna, is that you ended up being a police officer.
I did.
So can you tell us a bit about that and why did you become a police officer?
When I was about 10, I tried to take an overdose because I attempted suicide. Obviously, I wasn't successful. Then when I was about 12, something happened and I told Mum that I was going to commit suicide by gassing. I didn't tell her I was going to gas myself, but that was my idea. Gas myself in the bathroom. And so I went in there, covered up all the holes, like the drain hole, put a towel across the window, across the bottom of the door, all that sort of stuff. And we had old gas heaters in the bathroom to heat the water in those days, and just turned on the gas and waited for the gas to fill the room. And it just took too bloody long. I got
claustrophobic.
I got frustrated that I wasn't dying fast enough, and something just came over me, and I thought, you know, why should I kill myself? Because it's the best way I can get back at my mother and my uncle was to survive and to have a good life. And I thought, well, how can I best, because I wanted to help people who had been through similar things to myself. And I didn't think I was smart enough to go to university. So I thought the police force was the next best thing, that I could actually do something to help children in my situation. Before I applied, I rang up a police station and asked what services there were to help children. And the police officer I spoke to said, "What are you talking about? We don't have anything like that." And I was just struck dumb that, you know, with all the child abuse that was going on, even in the police force, they hadn't actually highlighted the need for support for children, let alone women in domestic violence. And it just, you know, so every part of society just turned a blind eye to abuse of women and children.
It did end up being a fairly positive experience being a policewoman for you.
Yeah. Absolutely. I loved being in the police force. You know, I worked with a fantastic bunch of people. The class that I went through in Sydney before police training went down to Goulburn, we were the largest group of females to go into the police academy, because before it was Neville Wran in about 78, 79, who asked for an inquiry into the police force and women in policing. And from that inquiry, so there used to be numbers of women that could go into the police force, so it might be 3 a year or whatever it was, but he just got rid of that and basically opened up applications to the police force to men and women, and women had the same duties as men did. And it was great. And I was very, very fortunate to go to North Sydney Police Station, which was a fairly young, like the community of police in that station were fairly young, and they didn't have a lot of the staid attitudes towards police, women in policing, like some of the other stations had. I know when we went back for a secondary training, quite a few, not one of them, but a few women who'd gone particularly out to the western suburbs and inner Sydney. They hadn't been out of the police station for the whole 10 months or whatever the probationary period was, because the sergeants and inspectors and whoever of their stations didn't believe that there was any place for women in policing. So they didn't get much experience at all, whereas North Sydney was fantastic.
And you would have obviously dealt with then as a police, even though you say there was no interest in it, you would have come across it. So how did that trigger you when you were doing your policing work? You would have come across situations of child abuse and...
Not as much as you would expect. Certainly not in North Sydney, because it's, you know, if it happens, it's very well hidden. But we did back in those days, because there was not many women in police, in the police force, we had what we called the rape cars. So there was one for the eastern suburbs, and there was another car for west and south Sydney. So I was in the north and east, and one night, just to tell you a little story, one night we were driving down George Street in Sydney, and this is about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, and we saw two young girls. One was about 10 and I think the other one was about 8 or 8 and 6, something like that. They were very, very young, and they're dressed up in their mother's clothes and, you know, just bait for any man who, you know, had other ideas. And they were walking past a group of bikies who had their motorbikes, you know, lined up, and they're at the pub and whatever. And some of the bikies were making lewd comments about these two young girls. And anyway, we picked them up, and the older girl was very worldly for her age. And we tried to, you know, we said, "Where do you live?" And she said, "The suburb." Okay, whereabouts in the suburb, just trying to get the information out of her as to where she actually, what her actual address was. She told us a furphy, but within the close to where she actually did live. And we went down this little laneway at the back of her place. And she, and so there was myself, another female officer, and a male officer. And the male officer said, "Well, I'll go home because I want to talk to your mother about the situation." Because the older girl had told us that her mother was asleep and she didn't worry about them being out at night, and had given them money to go to the movies and all this sort of stuff. Anyway, the policeman, he walked with them. They had to actually jump over a paling fence at the back of their house, climb in through the laundry window to get into the house. And so Todd went with them, of course, and he walked through their house, and the mother was nowhere to be seen. So these two young girls were walking the streets all hours of the night, and the mother was nowhere to be seen. So we ended up taking them to there was a house in the eastern suburbs where, you know, if kids were taken off their families, then they could go there until docs found somewhere further for them to stay, or until they returned to their parents. But these girls are just, ever since that night, I've often wondered whatever happened to them, because, you know, for young girls to be on the street at such a young age, it didn't augur well for their future. It was just heart-wrenching.
So then, Anna, you pivoted into nursing. And
in docs in between.
So then why did you become a nurse?
I never wanted to be a nurse, but after so I left the police force because I was pregnant, and my ex-husband and I split up when I was 8 months pregnant, because he'd met somebody else. And so I came back up to Maitland to live with mum and the partner she had at the time, who was also a beautiful man. And I went to uni and did social welfare, still thinking about, you know, looking after kids and stuff, but there weren't many jobs around at the time. So I ended up getting into docs, and I was there for 12 years before I got quite burnt out. And my brother had died a few years before from lung cancer. And when I was getting burnt out and realised I had to do something else, because It was just, I just couldn't keep going in docs. I better clarify there. With docs, I worked with people with disabilities, not young children. But after 12 years of working with docs, I had to retrain. So I, thinking about my brother, I thought that I'd like to be a palliative care nurse. So I went to uni and did nursing to become, with the sole purpose of becoming a palliative care nurse, which I did for about 13 years and absolutely loved it.
So, Anna, you've been through some unbelievable challenges and extremely stressful periods in your life. What's some of the things that you did to cope and get through?
As a child, you disconnect.
Right.
And I lived the vast majority of my life from when I was 8 years old to probably 50, just being disconnected from self. So it was like I was watching myself live my life, but not actually being involved in that, if that makes sense, because that's the only way I could cope. And so that was the only way I could really cope, because I didn't have to think about it. I just kept putting one foot in front of the other and did the best I could.
And how did that work where you've got two sons, and how did that impact on your parenting?
Particularly for my eldest son, so it was his dad who left me when I was 8 months pregnant. Particularly for him, because I was so disconnected, I didn't have any feelings except probably for rage and hatred. And for my eldest son, I had to learn how to love him. Most mothers say, oh, as soon as I saw the baby, I was instantly in love and all those sorts of things. And I really probably knew there was something seriously wrong with me, that I didn't feel love, I didn't feel anything for him. He was the most beautiful, perfect child, baby, child, adolescent, adult. I'm just so fortunate. But I had to learn how to love him. I had to watch. So what I really did is I watched Friends. So really because of one friend that I had at school, that if I hadn't met her, I really don't know where I would have ended up, because of the level of rage and hatred that I had within me. I could easily have become a sociopath, and I was probably bordering on that. In all honesty, I was probably bordering on that throughout my adolescence and early adulthood. You know, if I'd met the wrong person, I could easily have gone down that road. But as it was...
Sorry. So what's some of the things that she modelled for you? What was the things that, helped you out?
Well, we have been friends since we were 15 at school.
Right.
And... She got a boyfriend, so Mark, and everything that they did. So we were living down in Taro at the time with Mum's boyfriend Alan, who was, as I said, just beautiful. But every weekend, if they went out, I went with them. Like, I was involved in everything in their life, in their relationship. It was, Mark jokes that it's he was dating both of us, because, I was always sitting in the back seat, wherever they went. So just having that level of involvement, that I had an escape from my life, even if it was just one or two days a week on the weekends or something like that, and that she cared. Not that I felt her care, but I acknowledged her attention, I suppose. And, I suppose on some level, not that it was a conscious level, but on some level I thought, well, maybe I'm not as not as useless, not as horrible, not as, you know, whatever the thoughts were I had about myself. Maybe I wasn't worthy of the hatred that my mother had for me. And, you know, on some subconscious level, I'm not really, to be honest, I don't know. All I know is that her friendship was a turning point for my life. And as far as my children are concerned, with my eldest son, she'd had a baby about 18 months before me. And then, funnily enough, she rang me when I was living in Sydney and said, "Oh, guess what? I'm pregnant." And I said, "Yeah, so am I." And we're both due on Valentine's Day. So, but I ended up having a miscarriage, and then I subsequently had my eldest son. And just watching how she was a mother and how she showed care to her children, you know, what she did with them, all of this sort of stuff, but also, as funny as it might seem, I watched a lot of TV shows like The Partridge Family, Brady Bunch, My Three Sons, any of those sorts of shows, because I knew I didn't want to be the mother. When faced with being a mother, I knew I didn't want to be the mother that my mother was to me. So because I hadn't experienced what mothering was actually like, or how it felt, I had to learn how to do that. And even though I didn't feel it towards my children, or towards my eldest one particularly, I just went through the motions, and just over time, repeat, 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 it all started to sit within me. And I love for my child started to blossom, and the care of my children, of my son, started to blossom. And I just wanted to spend as much time as I possibly could with him. But having said that, in answer to your question, Melanie, is that as they got older, because I was so hurt as a child, I didn't want my children to be hurt. So I was probably overprotective. Not probably, I was overprotective. And my kids didn't like it very much because, you know, it was always, well, Johnny's parents are letting him do this, or, you know how kids are. And I just said, well, I don't care. And if they were going to someone's place, because I was so panicked, like I lived in panic most of my children's lives until they were adults, but I was so panicked that someone would hurt them, that I, you know, if they're going to a friend's place, you know, what's the friend they're going to? What's the phone number? I'd make sure I rang the parent and say, you know, to say, you know, my son's coming to your place. When do you want me to pick them up? You know, just to be involved in that side of things. But the, you know, really the main reason I was doing that is because if anyone had an idea of hurting my children, they would know that how involved I was in with my children, that I wouldn't let anything rest if anything happened to them. So it was like a warning signal to the prospective parents of, or whoever was at, in the household. So, and as I said, my kids didn't like it very much, but both of them as adults have said that they get it now.
Yeah.
Why I was so overprotective of them. But not so much that they get it based on my childhood, because they said that before they really knew anything about my childhood, but just the fact that I cared enough to do those things, even though they didn't like it.
Yeah. It's amazing that, you know, that experience of learning love, because you had no model at all when you were growing up. Yeah. And you know, it's an interesting thing to sort of share like your thoughts, that you could actually develop that love after learning it from other role models, a friend or from a TV show. I find that fascinating.
Mm. And obviously in the book, spirituality played a part, it sounds later in life, because you said to 50, but particularly you, paganism, which is a spiritual practice. Can you tell us a bit about that and how that helped heal in the later years and what importance that has for you?
Yeah. It all sort of started when I was about 10 onwards. I'm not really sure of the time, but from about that age. We moved from Maitland up to Rutherford and lived near the abattoir there. And I would have lots of dreams. Most of them were absolute nightmares. And, you know, I couldn't get any peace in the daytime and I didn't get any peace at night. So, you know, sort of 24 hours of abuse, you know, self-inflicted and not. But sometimes I dreamt about like a really powerful light that I couldn't really look at. It's like, but it was a white light. So it's like looking at the sun and not being able to see, you know, having to keep looking away. And I don't know, that just sat with me, that there was something more out there. And then I started having dreams about, you know, they weren't angels, they were just beings and the support of that. And then when I was about 40-ish, you know, I realised that I couldn't go on doing, so I was about 30. I realised I couldn't go on doing what I'd been doing because I was just, as I said before, I was separated from my life and I had to figure out a way of reattaching myself to my life. So, you know, for any life, you need a foundation. So because my foundation had been, you know, non-existent, I had to build a foundation for myself. And, you know, a lot of people look at religion and, you know, I'd been in a church choir and I'd gone to Sunday school and I'd gone to church on Sundays when I was in the choir and I'd prayed to God time and time again to save me. And, of course, you know, nothing happened. So I didn't turn towards religion. I just figured out, okay, well, what matters to me and where I live. So by this time I'd built my own home and had planted a lot of trees and things. And at this stage, when I was feeling really bad, I'd just go out in nature and I had a gum tree. And I know this sounds really crazy, but I had a gum tree and I'd go down and sit in its energy and it was so soothing. It was just amazing how soothing the energy of this tree was. And I tried it with other trees. The other trees were okay, but this was my tree that just helped soothe my anger or whatever I was feeling at the time. And so that sort of led me to looking at nature. And just over time, I developed ideas, you know, about the interconnectedness of everything, that, you know, a butterfly flaps its wings in Africa and, you know, a monsoon happens in America or wherever, you know, just that idea of the serendipity of experiences and just the flow of energy that creates good or not. And so I just developed this idea and I thought I was a bit crazy, so I never talked to many people about it. But then I read the Celestine Prophecies and it was, yes, yes, every chapter, yes, that's what I think. Yes, that's what I think. And it just reinforced in me that I wasn't crazy for having built this framework to build my life on, but that it was actually real as well, or at least other people thought.
Well, it's absolutely real. I mean, like there's a spiritual component of it, but, I mean, the fact is that nature is all interconnected. So, I mean, that's not anything crazy at all. So, you know, like anyone would say, spending time in nature really does ground you. It really does help with depression. It helps with anxiety. It helps clear your mind. It helps get good oxygen through your body. I think that the interconnectedness is all part of it as well, definitely.
Mm. Yeah, but my headspace back then, you know, it's not like now, I totally agree with you, but at the time I could hardly think outside, you know, what I was doing at that time, like, you know, because I'm still separated from myself.
Right.
Still disconnected. So the fact that I'd put that together, is something nothing short of a miracle in the first place. But then, you know, because a lot of my friends and people around me didn't have those thoughts, it was very much, you know, A equals B. There's nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
So do you think that that time in nature helped you reconnect?
Well, it was part of my process.
Yep.
Because I live on land now, and when I built my house, it was on, you know, like half an acre, which isn't a lot, but it's certainly more than what most people have. And I faced my house down my block of land rather than the street so that I couldn't see people particularly. And I built gardens in the front and I planted heaps of trees. Like I had about 40-odd trees in my front yard. Just having that nature around me did so much for my headspace. It was miraculous. But it's not something that I thought, I will go and build, you know, plant trees and that's going to help my mental health. It's just something, you know, it's about that connectedness. I just knew that I had to do it on whatever level, spiritual level, soul level, whatever. I just knew that I had to do it. And exactly the same, like I live on a small acreage now and I've done the same thing. Like I've planted heaps of trees, gardens, and it's just my space. And I drive in the driveway and it's, I can just breathe again. And, you know, the world is out there somewhere, but my place is just so comforting and calm and, you know, it's just lovely.
Well, the reason why I'm so interested in what you're saying on this particular topic is that, like for me, my battle with depression, being in nature was vital for me as well. It really was life-saving at times. You know, there was times where, you know, where things just seemed insurmountable, spending time bushwalking, surfing, on the beach, by a lake, and I still do it now. I just did it the last weekend, actually. I just had a bit of a rough trot for a month or so and just disconnect, go. I just spent time on nature on a little island and hardly spoke to anyone for a couple of days, and it's just, it makes such a big difference.
It does, yeah. So, I mean, for me, I don't need to go out anywhere because I've created my own.
Yeah, created it at home.
And I think there'd be people out there listening, and of course I'm a big one on this, but let's talk about justice. Mm. And you didn't get that at the end because your uncle was never held accountable.
No.
And I just wonder how you went through what would be justice for you, and what did that mean for you not having that resolved in the end?
Mm. Just to expand that question more, like most people, when you ask them what is child abuse, everybody, I would think, I won't say everybody because that's a sweeping statement, but I would say majority of people would say sexual abuse. But whilst my uncle's sexual abuse was horrific, my mother's abuse affected me even more. Like, you know, I just learnt that I was unlovable, I wasn't worth caring about, you know, all of those things, which actually allowed my uncle to do to me what he did. Because,
well, your mother didn't protect you.
No, nobody protected me. But it's not just that. It's that, you know, the beatings, and like when I was 4 years old, my brother and I, we were in Broken Hill, and my brother and I and some friends had gone to the pool, and like I'm 4 years old at this stage, so the other two friends, the younger daughter, there were two girls, the younger daughter was my age and the older girl was my brother's age, and we went to the pool, and I think someone must have stolen my sandals, and my brother gave me his thongs to wear home because it's like summer in Broken Hill, so you can imagine how hot it was, and like the road is, you know, you've got mirages all over the road from the, you know, the heat and everything. And when we got home and Mum saw that I didn't have my sandals, she made me walk back to the pool, which was over a kilometre, in the middle of the road with no shoes on. So just those sorts of things, you know, imagine what that does to a child's view of themselves, that your mother, who is supposed to love you, care about you, protect you. Yeah, I worship my kids, so I would go so far as to say your mother's supposed to worship you, that she just did not care about me in the least. And I would go so far as to say she hated me. So in answer to your question, Melanie, I never got any satisfaction from mum or from my uncle. So, you know, if you look at karma, my uncle died of cancer, and his wife died of cancer about 6 months after he did. My mother never took responsibility for her actions. She never acknowledged what she'd done. She never believed. Like, I went and talked to her one day about it, and I took my brother for support, and for support for her, I might add, that, you know, I knew I wouldn't be able to stay with her, and I thought she would be upset after I spoke to her. But my brother didn't even last the distance with the conversation. He took off. And he
How
slapped.
How old were you? That was a bit later, wasn't it?
Oh, that's as an adult.
As an adult, yeah.
Yeah. So that would have been about 95.
Yeah.
So, my brother, and I also, in this conversation, I told my mother about my uncle as well. And she said to me, oh, I thought he'd done something, but I thought he'd only done that once or twice rather than for, you know, 13 years. And she never accepted, you know, and I said, you know, about her behaviour towards myself and also my brother, but I couldn't speak for him. You know, that's his journey to do with what he wants. But my brother walked out, slammed the gauze door, and all my mother had to say was yelling at him, you know, if you've damaged my gauze door, you're going to have to pay for it. You know, and this is after I told her about the abuse I suffered at the hands of my uncle and the abuse I'd suffered at her hands. That was all she was worried about, was the bloody gauze door. So, you know, I didn't get any compensation, spiritual, emotional, or anything with either of them. But, you know, the part of healing, and the thing is, you know, when you've been through something like that, as I said, I was filled with rage and hatred for both of them and for myself. But eventually, I think with the idea of, you know, building my framework and going through the motions and learning how to be and those sorts of things, somewhere along the line, and I wasn't even aware of it happening until, you know, sometime down the track, I thought, oh, I don't care about that, you know, I don't feel any hatred towards mum anymore, and I don't feel any hatred towards my uncle anymore. I've just accepted it. You know, somewhere along the line, I just accepted that that's what happened to me. But, you know, in saying that, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you have to forgive the perpetrator and all that sort of stuff, which is, I think, is just utter rubbish, because I think it puts too much pressure on the person, the victim or the survivor, to go through that. I think what you need to work towards is saying, yep, this happened, it's in my past, but, you know, for all that I went through, I'm glad it happened. Would I want to go through it again? Hell no. But it's made me the person that I am today, and whilst I still have some sharp edges and some muddy edges, on the whole, I'm happy with who I am. And, you know, it's made me a more compassionate person. It's made me a more caring person. I understand people a lot more than what I might have done otherwise. You know, it's given me so many skills that I may not have had otherwise.
Anna, do you think that part of the healing process was finding the relationship with yourself and learning to love yourself?
Absolutely. I'm not sure that I really love myself, but certainly I don't hate myself.
Okay, great.
Which is, you know, is the difference. I accept, I'm comfortable with who I am. And I think, you know, that's really all I can hope for. Well, not, I don't know. It's all I can manage, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Talking about hope, what's your hopes for the future now? What's the hopes for you? What's the hopes for your children? You know,
I'm independent. I have own my own home. My children are well adjusted. They've both got great jobs. They've both got lovely girlfriends. They've both got futures that I never imagined for myself, let alone my children. And, you know, I don't have to have hope because I know I've got it covered.
Great.
Anna, I would like to finish that with the last sentence of the back of your book, which is the legacy that you leave for your readers. But most importantly, to each of you have been abused, you have everything you need to change your future. Harness your courage, take the road less travelled.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I've done. You know, with life generally, but particularly with abuse or people who have suffered from abuse, whatever that looks like for them, you know, anywhere you go, you're on a path to somewhere. Even if you choose not to go, you're still on a path to somewhere, wherever that may lead you. And, you know, for my life, as I said before, I could very easily have become a psychopath or a sociopath because of the level of anger and hatred that I had inside of me. But somewhere along the line, as I said, you know, meeting my friend, all of those, and the experience of living my life with her, that changed me on some level. And I decided that I wanted to have a better life for myself than I'd had. And then when I was pregnant, I certainly wanted to have a better life for my children, for my child, than I had. So it's just a matter of saying, you know, thinking to yourself, do I choose this option or do I choose this option? You know, this option takes me wherever it takes me. This option gives me a better future. So I'll take that option. And any decision you make, you need to have an idea of where you want to go with making that decision. You know, do I do drugs because that's going to take me to a life of misery? Do I, you know, pull myself up by the bootstraps, get a job, go to uni, learn a trade, whatever it is?
Build a garden.
Build a garden, whatever it is. You know, people don't find themselves drug addicts, and people don't find themselves, you know, alcoholics. People don't find themselves, you know, living on the streets particularly. They have made choices to get them there. And it's just about making good choices for you. And as Melanie said with that last part of my book, is that you have everything. Every person, regardless of education, regardless of anything, has within them the ability to change their lives. All they need to do is go in the direction, figure out a direction for their life and just keep putting one foot in front of the other. It's not easy. It wasn't easy for me. Like, it took me 20, 25 years, 30 years. Even now I'm still developing myself and building myself. But you've got to do the hard work. You know, you've got to figure out where you want to go, what you need to do to get there, and just do it. You know, and for every two steps forward, you might have three steps backwards, but over time, you still keep moving forward and you just got to keep your eye on the prize. And for me, what I did was had, you know, I started setting goals. You know, where do I want to be in 12 months, 5 years, 20 years, that sort of thing. And I know that sounds cliched.
No, not at all.
For me, if I didn't do that, I would be living in a housing commission house, you know, in wherever. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I've been able to make other decisions about where I wanted my life to be. And I wanted my children, as I said before, to have the best life that they possibly could. And for me to do that, I had to educate myself. I had to get a good job. I had to, you know, build a house. I had to have a place to call home for all of us. And, you know, it's just one thing on top of the other, just building and building and building and building. And, you know, my life is right for me. It's not right for everybody, but it's about you having the best life for you and you knowing that you have the capacity to build that life.
All right, Anna, that's great words of wisdom, and I think it's a great way to end the episode. Look, it's just been an amazing interview. Thanks for sharing. It must be hard, and I've seen the reviews on the book. Like you said before, I read some of the reviews on the book on the weekend, and everyone, like all the reviews were saying that, like they did feel as though they were part of the story, not just an observer. So I think, you know, like your story is incredible, incredibly painful, and I really thank you for sharing it with us. So, Anna, where can people get the book?
Well, because I self-published, because I did put it out to a few publishers, but, you know, they all sent me the letter, thanks but no thanks. So in the end I self-published, and so it's all on print on demand. It is in a few bookshops in the Maitland local area, and it is in a couple of libraries in this area. But if you want to purchase the book, you can purchase through Amazon or any of those sorts of places. You can go into your local bookshop and ask them to order it for you. Or if you live in the Maitland Newcastle area, I can drop off a copy and even sign it.
So just a reminder, it's called Blossom in the Dust by Anna Birch, if anyone's interested in getting it. So on Amazon or talk to your local bookshop, they'll be able to get your copy.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Anna, for coming on. And I've been with you on the journey of writing, and thank you so much for being so open and honest. And there will be listeners out there who will really connect with your story. And thank you.
You're very welcome, and thank you for being on the journey and critiquing my writing as we went along. And thank you very much, Sean. Lovely to meet you.
Oh, you too, Anna, you too. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. Another great episode. Thanks, Anna, for joining us. Look, talking about goal setting, Melanie and I are developing a product over the next couple of months. We just want to share that now. Melanie, tell us about it.
Yes, we're creating the Balanced Brain Wellbeing Journal that will help our listeners to transform all aspects of their life. That's what our podcast is about, so physical, mental, emotional and spiritual. We're going to share what's worked for us as we do in our podcasts in our healing journey, and give you tips, daily practices and exercises that you can bring into your own lives. And it's a great accountability tool, Sean. So yeah. I think it's the great part of the journal, and it's going to have some amazing stuff in there.
Yeah, great. So we're going to sort of share how that's developing over the next couple of months.
Send on Instagram about what you'd like to see in there, but it's coming out soon.
Yeah, great. Look, folks, to help us with the algorithm, don't forget to subscribe to the show. If you're a regular listener, we'd love for you to give us a review. It really helps us get the message out there. It helps us up the rankings, which allows us to share great episodes like this and great information with more people. So subscribe, write a review if you can, share the show with your friends. So thanks, everyone. I'll see you soon. Melanie, good to meet you, Anna.
Yeah. Thank you. You too.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.